Blog Talk Radio.
Give it to me straight with no chaser, no fakers, no artificial nothing. As a matter of fact, when I say straight, you say funk. Straight, straight. Oh. I know y'all out there. I hear. That's what I'm talking about. Welcome to Everybody is a Star. My name is Patrice Chocolate Banks, and I am your funkstress for the evening. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank God it's Friday. It's a hot one, too, here in Los Angeles. Everywhere else around the world, people are freezing all over the place. But here in L.A., it was in the 90s today. So I want to thank you for joining us again, and I just want to say that I hope that you are ready. You know how we do. You know you got to get your paper and your pencils out because you know that Funk 101 is now in session, and you need to be taking notes. And tonight, my guest tonight, I'm not even going to attempt, very rarely do I not even attempt to do an introduction, but I'm not even going to attempt to do an introduction on this brother because it really would seriously take too long. But I can tell you this, he is widely respected in the music game and has been for like at least, I'm going to say 30 plus years. I'm just going to leave that 30-plus years. He is a musician. He is a singer. And whoever, all my listeners, you have heard his voice, didn't even know you were listening to him, but he has done every genre, commercials, TV commercials, movie scores, albums. You know, you have heard him on something and didn't know you were listening to him. So having said all that, I would like to welcome tonight my dear, dear brother and friend, Mr. Jim Gilstrap. What's going on, Jimmy?
You are Patrice. Good to hear your voice.
No, you are going on, and I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to do Everybody is a Star with me. I really appreciate it. And so I don't want to, I want to make sure that I squeeze every drop out of this turnip. So we're going to start right now and get, because you have some favorite stories that I'd love for you to tell. And so I want to make sure that we get everything in. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So let's start with, I like to start from the beginning. I like to start from where a person was born. We'll start there. Where were you born?
I was born in a little town called Pittsburgh, Texas, and I was raised up about 6 miles away in a little town called Dangerfield, Texas.
Which is right around the corner from the little town I was born in called Tyler, Texas.
Tyler, Texas was not that far away.
East Texas, right there, that's right. So now, did you get a chance to go to school in Texas, or did your family hurry up and move out to California and get out that little small country town?
Well, I
like
started
mine
in the,
did.
Yeah, I went from the first grade through the 11th grade in Dangerfield, and then my family decided to move out of Texas, and I'm glad we did, you know, because there was so much, you know, prejudice and stuff going on down there that I'm glad to get out of there, so I've been here since 1963.
Okay, so now, all right, let's talk about your first musical influence. First of all, let's shout out your schools. What schools did you go to in Dangerfield? Elementary?
No, I went to this school. It was a segregated school called Joseph J. Rhodes High School. And it had grade 1 through 12, you know, in the school, since it was segregated, because there was like just all black school. You know, we didn't have any white students there. So,
and the town was so and the town was so small that the all the grades were in the school.
Literally. Not to mention, if you drove through the town and blinked your eyes, you missed the whole town.
So what were your first musical influences, Jamie?
My first musical influences started in Dangerfield in the church.
Uh-huh.
And Sam Cooke and his group, the Soul Stirrers, used to come down and perform, and my grandfather, who was a minister, they performed in his church. And I got, you know, kind of interested in singing through that.
And so what was the name of your grandfather's church?
It was St. James Methodist Church in Dangerfield, Texas. Yeah. And because of Sam Cooke, as soon as we moved to California, I hooked up with my buddy Augie Johnson from Side Effect, and we had this manager by the name of Bumps Blackwell, who was actually the one who did the orchestration for You Send Me. And Sam was my favorite. Sam was my favorite singer.
He was your favorite. So did you have any other influences besides Sam, or was Sam
it? It was Sam, and then actually on television down south, used to come on the Nat King Cole show, and I loved the smoothness of his voice and how he played the keyboard and, you know, just everything he sang. It was probably the most wonderful voice I think I'd ever heard. So I tried to imitate him and Sam, you know, and also Bobby Blue Bland.
Okay, I heard that. I like Bobby. I'm a fan of his, too. So now, when did you first sing in public?
In public? Well, I guess you could say it was in church.
Okay.
But, you know, my first professional gig, I think, was with Bumps. And we had this group called the Duprells at Washington High School. And Bumps had us on shows with Etta James, the Ken Folk, which is David T. Walker's group. I think we also did Dudos out in Compton. But those were like the first live gigs, you know, that we did.
So when did you, was it in church that you first got that feeling? Okay, I'm assuming that you sang in the choir and that you probably did some solos, right?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Okay, so now when you did, I don't know if you can remember when you did your first solo or not and how that made you feel, because, you know, a lot of times us as singers, there's like this particular moment that we have this epiphany, like especially when people are, if it's in church, if they shouting or if they, you know, just talking about, go ahead, sing that song, you know what I'm saying? And then you, and that makes you feel a certain way, certain type of way, and you realize, okay, this is what I want to do from now on. Did you get that feeling in church, or was
I got
it
that,
after?
I got that feeling in church when a lady came up to me and said, when I die, I want you to sing at my funeral. I was like, wow, do I sound that good?
That was pretty much a confirmation right there. Anytime somebody asks you to sing at their funeral, you know that you have really moved them.
Yeah,
okay?
It was best thing that ever happened to me, because I stayed in music from then on.
Okay, so now let's move on to your family moving to L.A. Tell me about that.
Well, we were in this little town. My best friend, one of my best friends, got shot by the sheriff down there, and he was still alive when they threw him in jail, but he wouldn't let a doctor in, you know, when the guy's mother came down. And I said, well, it's about time we got out of here. My mother said, well, I'm moving my family out of here because you never know what's going to happen. So they moved us out there in 63 after I finished the 11th grade. And we drove all the way to California, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Okay. So now tell me about coming from a little bitty town to was it Los Angeles that you came to?
It was Los Angeles, and when I started Washington High School, I used to walk like 22 blocks to get to school. You know, some mm-hmm. kids would drive taking the bus. I couldn't even afford the bus, but mm-hmm. I'd walk 22 blocks to school. I saw some kids driving cars and stuff. Like Augie, his parents bought him a car, so he drove, and I had to walk. And mm-hmm. it was a new experience, you know, when I got to school, and I met this young white girl who said, I see you walking to school every day. I said, yeah. She said, well, you can ride with me. And I was so paranoid because down south, if you got caught with a white girl, you're dead. I said,
absolutely.
I said, no, thank you. I think I'll just keep walking. It was the best thing I ever did. You know, mm-hmm. so I had, you know, I got plenty of exercise walking 22 blocks there and then 22 blocks back home every day.
Okay, and you went to Washington.
Washington High School. I think they call it Washington Preparatory High School now.
Yeah, I think they do. So now tell me about when you started meeting people, because after all, you were a country boy, and you mentioned Augie, and Augie, he was the slickest of the slicksters. So how did you manage to fall in, you know, with that crowd? How did that go? How was that transition?
Okay, I was walking home from school one day, and I walked past, I think it was Augie's house or something, him and his friends were singing doo-wop out by their garage. They had a bunch of kids hanging around, so they didn't have a bass singer. So I went up there and started just automatically singing bass with the group. And Augie said, wow, man, you good. He said, you want to join the group? So I joined his group.
Okay, and it was just as easy as that. And so what was the name of the group?
We call ourselves the Duprells.
Okay, the Duprells. Now,
yeah.
did Augie already have a manager at that time, or did you guys get the manager later?
We got the manager later. Our manager was Robert Bumps Blackwell, who was working with Sam Cooke, Little Richard, and I think Etta James and a whole bunch of people. But he signed us under his management when we were still in high school.
So how did you guys meet him?
Augie knew Bumps through his mother. And Bumps came by one of the rehearsals that we had and heard us singing. And he said, yeah, you guys are really good. So, you know, he just signed us up right away.
Okay. So how long had you been with the Duprells before you got signed?
We were probably together about a couple of months before
okay.
we got signed.
So that was pretty quick. That went kind of fast.
That was fast, and it was, I guess, because we sounded good, you know. And,
right.
It kind of made everything go fast. And I was doing leads with the group. I was singing bass with the group. I'd sing the parts in the background with the group. And, you know, a couple of the guys really weren't that good as singers. But, you know, between Augie and myself, you know, I think we kind of carried it.
Okay, well, tell me this. I'm hesitating here because I know Augie. And we're speaking of Augie Johnson, who later went on to form the group Side Effect. So now Augie had a bit of an ego. Now, so here you come. He probably was, like you said, one of the best vocalists in the group. And here you come, and you could sing. So what kind of, like, did he trip out on you? Or was he glad that he had somebody else in the group that could sing? You know, did he start ego tripping because you guys were young?
You know something? He really didn't. He didn't ego trip at all. He, you know, we kept, handing off leads, you know, between each other. And, you know, I was just glad to be in the group.
You know, okay.
I really didn't have anything else happening. So, and I knew I wanted to be in the music industry, so I was just glad to be there. But, you know, Augie was the one who had, like, that personality where people just gravitated to him, because I think he was in Bob Mitchell's boys' choir when he was young. They used to do the Danny Thomas show. They sang with Marilyn Monroe in a couple of places. He had already had like a name already, so it just made things even better when we got in front of people. And
yeah, he had a name and experience, and he was charismatic, and he could make you laugh. He could keep you cracking up. A little earlier you mentioned some of the other musicians that also went to Washington. I just want to shout them out because there were quite a few.
Start with John Barnes, who did all the music for Bebe's Kids, and Reggie Andrews, who also was with, you know, he produced the Daz Band, and then Augie, who had Side Effect. All four of us were in the band together. And then we had our sister, Teresa Graves, who sang with us occasionally. You know, she did Guess Christy Love and Laugh In. And, you know, she was in the Doodletown Pipers before you and I got there.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And all out of Washington, boy. It's good
all
that
out of Washington.
You guys... Ooh, because you guys was rough over there, so it's good y'all had music to keep you guys kind of distracted.
We were some hard heads.
Because Washington was kind of rough over there. Okay, so now tell me about the Duprells and how their career got launched. After you got Bumps as your manager, then what?
We actually went into the studio, and we cut a record called Ubla Duce with Bumps and this guy named Rene Block, who is a big-time arranger. And, you know, Bumps had us singing on shows with, like I said, with Etta James, with David T. Walker's group, the Kenfolk, him and Buzzy, the piano player. And he had us all over the place. We did Dudos out in Compton, the Marriott. And an interesting story is he had us at the Marriott with Sir Lady Java.
And I remember Sir Lady Java.
Sir Lady Java was on stage at the Marriott doing the striptease, and Bumps didn't tell us it was a dude. So we're all out there, and Sir Lady Java is doing her little striptease, and she took off this bra and, you know, laid it out. And Bumps said, "Now, you guys, watch this." And she turned around and threw up her arm. Aha! And everybody went, "Oh, that's a dude."
But you know what? You know, there was a magazine called The Scoop, or The Soul Magazine and The Scoop Magazine. And you remember those? And Sir Lady Java was always, they were always advertising him, because it was a man, always advertising him being everywhere. He worked all over the place in Los Angeles. But that was the prettiest man,
young dude,
that I have ever seen in my life. He was prettier than a whole lot. I mean, it was just hard to believe that that was actually a man.
Yeah.
You know, it was expensive. You took me back when you said Sir Lady Java, because I used to look at that picture and say, there's no way this has got to be some kind of, you know, a trick. There's no way this could be a man.
Well, believe it or not, I saw Sir Lady Java about 4 years ago at one of Frida Payne's shows, and she is now a full-fledged woman.
Oh, okay. Well, that had to be coming, because she looked like one back then. Okay.
Yeah.
So now Bumps had you guys all over the place, and you were building up a following. So so what was the next level? What happened after that?
The next level was with me. After, you know, when I went to college, I started singing in the Madrigal Choir. and kind of got away from the Duprells. And the guy in the college, what's his name, John Biggs. He was a choral teacher. He had me singing in, with Roger Wagner Chorale, and also had me downtown at the Shrine being one of the actors in Aida with Leontine Price.
Oh, okay.
So I had to move from the Duprells to, kind of the classical feel.
And sounds kind of like operatic, too, a little bit.
Yeah, operatic. And after that, I ended up going to Vietnam.
So I forgot to ask you this. Here's what I want to know. What did your family think about here you guys are in Los Angeles, coming from a small town in Texas, and you get here and you want to be in the Duprells. You want to do music now, and you doing local gigs around town. What did they think about that? Because, back in the day, our parents and grandparents and stuff, they didn't really take music as something that was to be done seriously unless you were doing it in church. So when you start talking about you're going to be a singer or a musician, a lot of times they didn't want to hear that. So how did your family receive that?
Well, they received it like this. Boy, you ain't going to never be like, why don't you go out and get a real job? It's like after a while, I think once I came out of the war, and I think you were already in the Doodletown Pipers, and I got in the group, that's when things changed.
Mm-hmm.
Then they were okay, especially I think the time that we did the Ed Sullivan Show, it's like they were all goo goo gaga over it then, so.
Yeah, because I know it definitely was my first professional gig because
yeah.
They came to my high school and auditioned. The people that were picked out of the choir at my high school, Mr. McNeil picked me as one of the ones to audition. So like almost straight out of high school, I went into the Doodletown Pipers. Now, for people who keep hearing us mention Doodletown Pipers, I'm going to let you explain what kind of group Doodletown Pipers was.
Well, it was kind of, they call it white bread group, but it was mostly white singers. And I think there was about maybe 5-6 of us, black singers. And we used to do the Ed Sullivan Show. I think before I got with them, they had done the Phyllis Diller Show. We did a show in New York called That's Life with Robert Morse. And, we did Vegas like 6 months a year at the Frontier Hotel. We opened for, Harry James. We also opened for Phil Harris in the main room at the Frontier. And then we did the lounge with Frank Sinatra Jr.
Yeah. It was basically a what they call a middle of the road apple pie type group,
Yeah.
And there were mostly, I think it was 16 of us.
Yep, 16 singers. Still remember all the singers.
Excuse me, I was choking there for a minute.
Uh-oh.
I'm quiet. And, we're still friends with a lot of the singers. Like you said, you and Augie was already there. I was already
right
there when you got there. But Augie went on to form the group Side Effect.
Right.
Teresa James, whose place I took, she went on to be the lead character in Get Christy Love. And I don't know if that was the first time that had happened or not. Was that the first time a black woman had ever been the main character of a television series?
She actually went to Laugh-In first, and then she got her own show from Laugh-In, and she was the first black woman to have her own network TV show called Get Christy Love.
Oh, but you know what? What about that one? You know what? Who I forgot about, though? Diane Carroll, Julia. Teresa wasn't the first one because Julia was before her.
I think, I'm not sure if Julia was before or after Christy Love, but it might have been either Diane Carroll or Teresa Graves who had their first network show. And
yes.
Teresa gave up her show to become, a real active member in the Kingdom Hall, and she
mm-hmm.
let the show go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And let me see. Well, most of the black people in the Dual Time Pipers did go on to do greater things, you know, which was kind of ironic because a lot of them weren't really expecting that, you know, the other members of the group. Although it was a very good experience, I will never forget. It was priceless. It was my first professional gig, but I think that by the six little black members going out, you know, making marks in the music industry for real and in the TV industry and stuff, I think it took a lot of them by surprise.
Well, I don't think they quite expected, you know, us to do what some of us did. Because I remember when I was in the group, the Dual Time Pipers, they were really high, I think, on Augie.
Right.
Eat parts. And that was just, you know, what they wanted. It reminds me of this guy named Stoney Jackson, who one of the producers over at, MGM or somewhere, he says, "Isn't he beautiful?" I was like, "Yeah, he looks all right to me, but I don't think he's beautiful." So they tried to push Stoney. They tried to push Stoney Jackson, but Robert Townsend turned out to be the big wig in that group that he had. You know,
yeah.
So Robert took off, and you know, Augie did okay, but you know, he really didn't do, I think, as much as I thought he was going to do. And neither did Mike Campbell and Tommy Webb, because they were trying to groom them to be, like, the next duo. You
right.
know, like Bill Cosby and Robert Culp. But it,
right.
it just never happened, you know. So.
Right. But
you
that
know,
was a great
people,
experience. I had a good time.
I had the best time of my life in the Dual Time Pipers. Thanks to you and, you know, Augie, and even Tommy Webb. You know, I love Tommy Webb and Mike
Campbell.
Well,
you know, you became my brother. That's when we became, because, you know, when you're out on, like you said, we were in Vegas for like 6 months off the year. So, you know, and we were living with one another. Dual Time Pipers was ripping us off because they were making us pay for our own rooms out of our own little pay that they were giving us. But, you know, we didn't know any better. I know I didn't know any better. But anyway, formed some relationships, some lifetime relationships. And so it was a priceless experience. So now, where did you go from after leaving the Dual Time Pipers?
Well, after the Dual Time Pipers was when I connected with the session singers, you know, the session singers here in L.A., gentlemen like Tom Baylor, Ron Hicklin, some of these guys, they were, like, busy doing TV shows, movies, commercials, and because of my sight-reading ability, I think they kind of pulled me in with them. I didn't see any prejudice, you know, when I got in. They just pulled me in because of my ability. I don't even think it had anything to do with race, you
mm-hmm.
know, but they just pulled me in because I could sing with them, and they didn't have to come in the studio and teach me my part. I think my first session I did was with Darlene Love.
Oh, okay.
And the group, The Blossoms, her and Fanita and Gene King. And me and Augie did a session with them, but they couldn't read. So the producer had to take them to the piano, and me and Augie went over and sat down while they learned the thing, and then we got up and read our parts, you know, like from the sheet.
Right.
So it was like a whole different area of the business that I didn't know anything about. But I'm so glad I got into it. You know, it was wonderful.
Now, how did you get introduced to it specifically?
Well, I got introduced through, I'm trying to remember now, it was a couple of singers, you know, a couple of the white singers, and, you know, a couple of them asked me, they said, "You read, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I had to read to get into Doodletown Pipers." So they called me on sessions to see if I could read. And because I read better than some of them, they just kept calling.
Okay, so it's very, I don't know how important it is now in these days and times, because during this time you're talking about, that session work was very cliquish. I mean, once you got into it, if you were blessed enough to get into it, they kept using the same singers over and over again. And it was imperative to be able to read music because they did not want to waste time because they were paying you money. So they want you to go in there and read that stuff and do it right away, and so that they could get you out of there and that they could be assured that it would sound good, because you had a beautiful voice and it was a matter of blending. Now, one thing about that session thing that always got me, though, was that, you know, like you said, the Blossoms. Now, the Blossoms and Darlene Love, they were the first female group of any color to do background vocals for anybody, period. They are the one that cracked that, you know, that genre wide open. So, and they couldn't read music. So the thing about it is that I understand the importance of being able to read music back then. I know that it was important, but most of the time, 9 times out of 10, if you go into a black person, goes into a session and hears the song once or twice, then it's a done deal. You know what I'm saying? It's a done deal. You already had it. It wasn't like it was, you know, rocket science or anything. You already had the melody, and you were good to go for the most part. But that was a way of keeping that session thing real cliquish, because they did keep a lot of people out because of that. But everybody, though, that was doing the session thing, though, Jimmy, everybody couldn't read music, could they?
Well, I'll put it this way. Most of the white singers all read.
Yeah, I know they did.
Okay, the black singers, unfortunately for most of them, they couldn't read. And I really never called it a click more than, if it was a click, it was just readers. And, you know, when I was doing the Carol Burnett Show, there was like 30 singers, I think, that were doing the music, and there was maybe 3 black singers.
Right.
A young lady named Myrna Matthews and John Layman and myself when we first started doing the Carol Burnett Show. But we could read music on a level that was high enough for them. You know, we were still tokens, but we were on a level of most of those singers. You know, there's always a few singers that were just literally perfect. You know, they could read anything. Those were the college grads and stuff like that. You know, they all went in the studio and they just passed out the music and, you know, boom, 1, 2, 3, and then we started singing. But that was hard for black singers to actually do back in those days. And with me, it was the college training that I had, I think, that really kept me in the door. And also, it didn't hurt, you know, later on when I got with Stevie, because people think you're God when you sing with Stevie Wonder. You know, and I had the reading ability, plus I sang with Stevie, so they just put me on a pedestal compared to most of the other black singers. And, you know, I really had nothing to do with it, but I appreciated it. And they just kept calling me, and they were always questioning me about singing with Stevie and some of the people over at Motown. You know, it was, you know, it was that kind of a thing where we weren't just readers. The black singers weren't mm-hmm. just Peters. Because even John Layman, John had a deal over at A&M Records.
Mm-hmm.
And Quincy Jones was going to produce him.
Right.
You know, so it wasn't just that he could read. He was a talented brother who could just go in there and do everything. He was
right.
a great keyboard player. And I think that was what kept the three of us, and just the fact that we could read added, you know, to the mystique of, you know, us as singers.
Right. And which is a good thing. I mean, it's always good to hone your craft for sure. So reading
yeah.
was very important. And so I'm not downplaying it at all because it was very important. I mean, it made some people rich, including you. So, but I didn't realize that you, okay, so I thought you did the session work first and then Stevie, but you did, so we skipped the whole Stevie part. So let's go back to when you got with Stevie.
Well, actually, I was with this group called The Reason Why with my college classmate, Jerry Peters, and Jerry was producing, you know, Going in Circles and all that, Love or Let Me Be Lonely by the Friends of Distinction. And Stevie heard an album that The Reason Why cut, me, Stephanie Spruill, and this girl named Lonnie Groves and Willie Hill. And Stevie heard us singing on the album that Jerry cut for Jerry Butler and Memphis Records. So he asked us to come join his group. You know, he asked me and Lonnie to come to New York and live with him and his girlfriend, and that's what we did.
Now, this is one of my favorite stories that you tell, living with Stevie. How long did you live with Stevie?
I think it was close to 2 years, not quite 2 years, but we lived in Queens, New York, at 67th and Queens Boulevard, and I think it was second or third floor on this apartment, and it was me and Lonnie Groves and Stevie Wonder and this girl named Yvonne Wright, and we stayed there for almost 2 years while Lonnie and I sang in his first Wonder Love group with Linda Lawrence, who went to the Supremes later, and
right.
this girl named Gloria Barley, who just passed away, I think, last month, about a month ago. And
okay.
we were the first Wonder Love singing group. And
now, what was it like to be Stevie Wonder's roommate? What was that like? I know you don't have enough time to tell us everything, but, like, did he ever sleep? I mean, you know what I'm saying?
He really didn't sleep. Most of the time he was working on his tunes.
Right. Because to him there was no day and no night. So most
right.
of the time he was just working on the tunes. So what were you doing? Were you trying to keep up with them? Or what was your life like in that time period?
Well, I wasn't making a whole lot of money. But, you know, I had to drive Stevie all over the place. We cut, I think, the Music of My Mind album that Stevie first got his first gold album. We cut that at Electric Lady, Jimi Hendrix's old studio in New York. And I used to drive him from Queens over to the Village, Fifth Avenue, and then we went in and cut the album. But I didn't really hang with Stevie that much. You know, it's like I was spending my time with my girlfriend, Lonnie Groves. But, you know, I did hang with him a lot because I wanted to learn from him. And
mm-hmm.
I used to sit on stage and look down as he was playing and watch his hands. And I got a chance to see how he was playing all those tunes. His chords were almost magical. You know, they gave
uh-huh.
me goose pimples. You know, you got goose pimples from just listening to him. And
uh-huh.
he was the first genius that I ever really worked with. You know, and I have to admit, the man is a genius even today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was a learning experience.
Right. Well, I just got to ask this: who cooked, and what was Stevie's favorite thing to eat?
You know something? Most of the time, I think Yvonne did the cooking. Yvonne Wright. I think she wrote "Blame It on the Sun." And blame it on the sun. She wrote that song, co-wrote it with him, and I think a couple other tunes too. But she was the one who did the cooking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did Stevie have something favorite? The favorite dish?
You know, I can't really remember. He ate whatever she cooked, so she was really good at cooking. You know, I just remember that.
And you
were
good at cooking, too. You never cooked?
Occasionally, I might make a banana pudding or something, you know.
Okay. I heard that. So what we're going to do is we're going to listen to one of the songs that you submitted, which is You Are the Sunshine of My Life. And You Are the Sunshine of My Life, that is, for those who don't know, that is you on the intro right there. That is your vocal singing.
Yeah.
And then after you sing that your part, then that's Lonnie that's singing right after you, correct?
Right. I sang the first lead part, Lonnie sang the second lead part, and then Stevie came in and took over the rest of the song. And we all sang the backgrounds.
Right, right. Okay, well, here we go. You Are the Sunshine of My Life. Right, that's one of my favorite songs, maybe because you're on it.
Oh, thanks, Patrice.
Yeah, that's a beautiful song. Okay, so now.
All right.
How long did you sing with Stevie? When did? Because I know you pursued a solo career, so how long were you with Wonder Love before you left Stevie and started pursuing your own career?
I was there probably just those couple of years. And then I came back to L.A., and I was sitting home one day, and I got a phone call from Quincy Jones, and he asked me to come in and sing lead on his Body Heat album, which I did with Leon Ware and Minnie Riperton, and I sang this song called Buffalo Soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think about an hour after that, I got a call from Henry Mancini. And
wow.
Henry Mancini asked me to come in and do this movie with him called 99 and 44, 100% Dead with Chuck Connors and Edmund O'Brien. And I did the theme to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I started from there. It was just a cakewalk to do the session work.
Okay. Well, what about your album?
My album, actually, I was signed by Bell Records first. I cut four or five tunes on Bell, and that didn't work out. So later on, I went and signed with Chelsea Records, Roxbury Records, and I did this song called Swing Your Daddy. And it went like a big-time hit record all over England and America, and I was, you know, I was really blessed. So.
Okay. Well, that's what we're getting ready to listen to right now. We're getting ready to listen to Swing Your Daddy. Now, did you write this?
No, Kenny Nolan wrote it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So you didn't write, so he wrote the melody and the lyrics.
He wrote everything because he had already had hit records on Lady Marmalade with Patti LaBelle, My Eyes of Georgia with Frankie Valli, and then he wrote Swing Your Daddy.
Okay, I guess he did write everything in that, in that case. All right, well, here we go. Swing Your Daddy.
Okay.
You got guns, guns out of control. My
bring your daddy. And listen to you trying to sound sexy, Jimmy.
Oh, feels so good.
So, now, one of my favorite stories, well, one of the most interesting stories you tell, because I'm a huge Jackie Wilson fan. I think it was Jackie Wilson, or was it Sam Cooke? One of them, you know, you had that story. Who was it?
Sam Cooke.
It was Sam Cooke. Okay, tell the Sam Cooke story.
Well, when I was with the Duprells back in high school, and Bumps had called the group together and told us we were going to go sing behind Sam in Tokyo, in Japan. And that was the night that Sam, unfortunately, got killed. He was shot like a block and a half from my, you know, my parents' apartment. And I was walking home from a party that night and saw them rolling his body out of that motel, the Hacienda Motel, on 92nd and Figueroa. And I didn't even know it was him. So I packed my bags that night, got up the next morning and walked all the way down to Florence and to one of the other singers' house, Richard West. And Bumps called us there and said, "Guys, we ain't going nowhere. Sam Cooke got killed last night." And I flashed back.
Go ahead.
You know, I flashed back to that night, and I didn't realize that I was watching them roll his body out of that motel.
Right. That is so cosmic. That story trips me out every time you tell me that, because, wow, here you were on your way home and packing and everything and not realizing that that's who you were seeing. And that was your, like, one of your idols.
It was my idol, and every time I heard a change is going to come, I had to shed a few tears because he was my favorite singer at the time, you know, when I was in the Duprells. So it kind of hurt, you know, just to know that he wasn't around and to know that we may have had a record deal on his label.
Right, and because I know you had to be looking forward to singing with him and working with him. You had to be.
Yeah, I was looking forward to it, and, you know, especially him being such a great singer. And, you know, he was working with a guy that Bumps introduced us to, Mel Carter, Hold
right.
and Thrill Me. And
Bumps
took us by Mel Carter's apartment, and Mel was sitting in front of his record player listening to all those songs. And I think Sam let him sing one of his songs. And, you know, it didn't work out there either, but Mel tore that song up. But
I think Sam produced Mel, or Mel was on Sam's record label or something, wasn't he?
He was on Sam's record label. He was
right.
One of the guys Sam admired.
Right.
You know, Mel is a great singer.
Right. I remember him. I remember him. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now, after your albums did what they were going to do, you had this hit with Swing Your Daddy. Where did you go in your career after that?
Well, after Chelsea Records, I concentrated more on, you know, the studio work, because that was, especially the TV commercials, because that was where money was lucrative, and, you know, most of my white friends were, you know, just making all kind of money in commercials. And I said, well, let me concentrate on that, and I didn't need a manager to do that. So I stuck in that area of the business, especially the commercials that we did. I think me and James Ingram and his brother Philip did a commercial for Peter Pan Peanut Butter. You know, went to a party and what did I see? Peter Pan Peanut Butter. And
I remember that.
Yeah, we sang that commercial. And Bobby Sheen, who sang with, Phil Spector. Bobby sang the lead. Me, Philip Ingram, and James Ingram did the backgrounds. But I know I made like $40,000 for the year off that one commercial.
And that is all she wrote. That's all you needed to see, huh?
All I needed to see, because I concentrated on getting as many commercials as I could, because with all of those running every, you know, throughout the year, you had checks coming in for days, and, you know, you didn't have to worry about managers or anything like that. So it was, you know, just a great time for me.
I know it was. Now, another one of my favorite things to brag about you on is the fact that you did the theme song for Good Times. Now, tell me, how did you get that gig?
Okay, Good Times we did in 1974, and Good Times was written by Dave Grusin. He did the music, and Alan and Marilyn Bergman did the lyrics. And my ex-girlfriend at the time was a lady named Marty McCall, and she called me on the session. When I got there, I didn't know I was doing the lead. So we got into a studio called TTG up on Highland and Sunset, and me and this young lady named Blinky Williams went in and sang the lead, and we also went in and sang the background with Marty and Myrna Matthews, Lisa Roberts, you know, her dad was Tommy Roberts, and Evelyn Roberts, they were their parents. But we went in and did the backgrounds, and, you know, next thing I knew, it was on the air in 1974.
All right. Well, here we go. This is, I love bragging on you about this one, because I grew up on Good Times. So here we go. Good Times. Quick, and y'all are just singing y'all's faces off, just, you know, in that, what was that, a minute or something?
It was actually a whole song. They took out some of the lyrics because they were offensive to black people.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they took out, they're looking out of the window, watching that song grow, thinking, roaches roaming the hallways. Landlord is nobody's fool. He lives on the other side of town. They took that stuff out because they didn't want to.
Roaches roaming the hallways.
Roaches roaming the hallways. Landlord is nobody's fool, because they didn't want black people to be offended by the show. So they took
right.
that lyric, you know. But
right.
I enjoyed singing it. It was one of my favorite things to do, and Blinky and I still call each other and keep in touch, you know.
Okay, because she is still out there. Blinky been out there forever doing her thing. I saw her not too long ago myself. Okay,
yeah.
So now you are probably the most prolific male session singer that has ever been. I know that you got some buddies out there that you sing with all the time. Like you mentioned the Ingram Brothers, and also you used to do a lot of work with Phil Perry.
Phil Perry, Philip Ingram. I think Philip Perry and Philip Ingram were the best and longest lasting, I guess, black commercial singers for a while. And we did so many commercials from the, you know, the no-skin chicken for, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's. We did everything. And
you sure did everything. And you did sing with Augie for a minute, too. Weren't you in Side Effect for a minute?
I was in Side Effect after I got out of Stevie Wonder, actually. And I was in the first group where we went and cut an album in Canada. And I think I wrote 9 of the 10 tunes that were on the first album and played the keyboard. I was actually in the band and playing keyboard, and, you know, Augie and Greg and Louie and Lamita Johnson were the singers. And
right.
I sang sometimes, and, you know, but most of the time I was playing with the band.
Okay. Well, I have a list here in front of me of some of the people that you have worked with, your credits, a list of your credits, and I am not going to try to read them all because it must be about 100 of them here in front of me, but I'm going to name some of them. Okay, so here we go. Patty Austin, Anita Baker, George Benson, Dee Dee Bridgewater, Brothers Johnson, Donald Byrd, Ray Charles, George Duke, Aretha Franklin, Jose Feliciano, Kenny G, Saida Garrett, Johnny Gill, Herbie Hancock, Wayne Henderson, Thelma Houston, Whitney Houston, Phyllis Hyman, James Ingram, The Jacksons, Michael, Al Jarreau, Quincy Jones, Elton John, B.B. King, Ramsey Lewis, Melissa Manchester, Ricky Martin, Minnie Riperton, Lionel Richie, Linda Ronstadt, and remember, people, I'm not even reading them all, okay? Joe Sample, Santana, Boss Gags, Tom Scott, Ringo Starr, Barbara Streisand, James Taylor, Tower Power, Narada Michael Walden, Dionne Warwick, and of course, Stevie. Nancy, and let me throw in Nancy Wilson. I'm going to throw her in simply because I know that you have always had a crush on Nancy Wilson.
Well, since I was in the Doodletown Pipers, I think when Nancy sang at the Sands, I actually made a pass at Nancy. But all she said was, "Now, you should know better. You're just a little boy."
That was so funny. Jimmy said, "Shoot, I'm going to go for mine, make this pass at Nancy right quick." But,
that's right.
You guys became friends after that, though, didn't you?
We did, and I actually worked with Nancy on some of her records. She was actually in the same hospital with her husband who passed away. When my baby brother, was in the same hospital with her husband, right down the hall. And I ran into her in the hospital, and my brother's still in a nursing home, but her husband passed away. And she was really distraught, and, you know, I definitely understood, you know, that's hard to...
Yeah.
But she's a beautiful. Yeah,
that was funny to me. I said, "No, you didn't." When you told me that story that you made a pass at Nancy, I said, "No, you didn't."
Yes,
okay,
so
you are alive and well and still adding your golden vocals to many people's projects. Tell us what you've been doing most recently.
I actually wrote 4 songs on Little Anthony and the Imperials, their last CD. They cut 4 of my songs on there, and I did most of the tracks here in my studio. And they just transferred them to Las Vegas and then sang over them. Also, I'm on the road with Loose Ends, Jane Eugene. She's a wonderful lady, and I enjoy being out on the road with them, and they're a fun group. Some great singers in the group, and my buddy Jerry Peters' cousin, Craig T, is the MD, and they got some great musicians, great singers, and also I sing occasionally with George Benson. We did the Hollywood Bowl, and 2 summers ago I was out with James Taylor, and we did a summer tour. And I took this guy named Arnold McCullough's place They're going to be at the Hollywood Bowl on, I think it's June the 7th, and I'm going to go see, you know, James and, you know, just kind of hang out with the brother because he's an incredible musician and just a great guy. So I'm still out here doing it. I teach music at Frida Payne's niece's school. I still teach sight reading. So, you know, I'm out here busy and still keeping it going.
Okay. So are you signed to a label right now? Are you doing – well, people don't really sign the labels anymore. You just – you, for all practical purposes, you have your own studio, basically your own label, huh?
Well, I've cut – I got three songs that are out on internet radio. One is called Four Walls. The other is called I'm Missing You. And I did a duet with a friend of mine, a girl named Van Johnson. And there's a duet out on Us, and it's on internet radio. And I've been doing Bishop Don Juan's radio show. I've done it twice. And, you know, other shows from Detroit, Atlanta, London. I'm supposed to be doing a radio show from London pretty soon. So I'm just keeping busy.
I heard that. So I want to say that last night, and I think that you've worked with her. She's a friend of yours. I want to just take time out to acknowledge that the passing of the songstress Jessica Cleave, she passed last night. And I just want to say that, you know, another one is gone. And you and Jessica, didn't you work together? Or, you know, didn't you... Wasn't she a friend of yours?
She was a friend of mine, and I'll probably, you know, punish myself because I didn't get back to her. We were supposed to go have lunch together, and it just never happened. But, you know, I was around Jerry Peters when he was working with the Friends of Distinction, and that was Barbara Love and Jessica Cleaves and Floyd and Harry Elston, and they... you know, I had a good time hanging around Jessica. She was just a beautiful woman, a gorgeous voice. Her voice was probably like would melt butter. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I'm going to miss her.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people are going to miss her. Jessica was with Friends of Distinction, Earth, Wind, and Fire, and also P-Funk. So we just want to, you know, pay homage to her and let her know that we're going to miss her. So, Jimmy, we're about to wrap this up, but before we do, I would like to know, do you have any advice for up-and-comers?
Well, the only advice I can give is, it comes from when I was living with Stevie Wonder. I sat and watched that man work on music most of the day and night. Some people call him a genius. I just call him a hard worker. He'd be up all night. 18 hours, and I try to do the same thing because I want, you know, there's always somebody better than me or better than, you know, the other people out there, but you want to stay ahead of them by continually studying. So just keep singing and keep working at it, and you'll get there.
Okay. That's good advice, of course. Stay ahead of them. That's what I'm saying. Try to stay ahead of them. So, got any shout-outs?
Any shout-outs?
Yeah.
Let me give a shout-out to Mike and Elaine Campbell from the Dualtown Pipers, to Miss Frida Payne. She's one of my best good friends, and Sherry Payne, her sister, who was in the Supremes. You know, just all my friends, you know, and especially Miss Van Johnson, I have to give it to her. She's one of the best singers that I've ever run across. And, you know, I just want to tell her how much I appreciate her visiting with my brother in the nursing home. She's a wonderful lady, and I just want to thank her.
Okay. So now where can we go to find out about what Jimmy is doing? Are you on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that? Where can we go to find out what you're doing, what's happening with you?
Okay, I'm on Facebook, and you can Facebook me anytime, and that goes for any of my friends. if you're listening, just give me a shout out on Facebook, and I'll answer you back. You know, I'll let you know what I'm doing. And, you know, that's about the only place you can really get in touch with me. So.
Okay, well, that's good, because that's the only place everybody is anyway, is on Facebook. And I have to say this. I have to let the world know that Jimmy makes the best sweet potato pies. I'm going to go so far as to say in the whole wide world, okay? He makes the heck out of a sweet potato pie. And during the holiday seasons, I make sure that I get plenty of them. And on my way out, I would like to say for all things chocolate, go to PatriceChocolateBanks.com. I want to shout out my family. I want to shout out Tribe Family Channel, the creator of Beverly Black Johnson. I want to shout out the Funkalutionary, Stozo, my partner in crime, Team Chocolate. I want to say God bless all of you. Remember that everybody is a star, but your shine is just different from mine. Once again, sending a prayers for Jessica Cleve's family and everybody that loved her. And just want to say, Jimmy, that once again you have come through for me, and we've known each other for so long. We are so far past being friends. It's all about being family, and I love you very much, and glad that you took this time out with me. And on our way out, we're going to play the rest of the song that you submitted. This next song we're going to play on our way out is Hanging on a String by Loose Ends.
Hey.
I'll be around, and Heaven Must Be Like This. Those are some of your favorites. So we're going to go out partying on those. And thank you so much, and I'll be talking to you real soon.
Love you, Patrice.
I love you, too, and may the funk be with you, my brother.
Hey.
All right. Talk to you later.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
know what I think heaven is? I think heaven is you. You know that? Be like this. Heaven.
system.